Nikatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling something pretty fundamental, how World War I actually began. For, well, decades, really, the standard story pointed the finger mainly at Germany.
Right, the Kaiser and German aggression. That's been the dominant narrative.
But the book we're diving into today, Christopher Clark's The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War in 1914, it completely challenges that.
It really does. And it's more than just, you know, academic revisionism. It's about reframing how we understand major crises.
Yeah.
The old narrative, the one baked into the Treaty of Versailles, served a purpose back then.
Mm.
Clark steps back.
And asks a much more useful question for us, I think. Instead of who's to blame, which is always loaded.
Always.
He asks, how did this happen? How did this massive catastrophic failure unfold across all the major powers? It's like looking at a huge organizational breakdown.
Exactly. And to do that properly, you need someone who could look beyond just one country's viewpoint.
Absolutely. So tell us about Christopher Clark. Why is he the one to take on this century-old consensus?
Well, so Christopher Clark is genuinely one of the heavyweights. He's the Regius Professor of History at Cambridge. His work on German history, especially Prussia, his book Iron Kingdom is a classic, is incredibly well respected.
So he knows the German side inside out.
Precisely. Which means when he argues against pinning all the blame on Germany, it carries real weight. It's not just an outsider lobbing critiques. It's coming from deep expertise.
And it's not just his German expertise. It's how he researched this, right? He didn't just stick to the usual London-Berlin archives.
That's key. He deliberately went much wider. Extensive work in Serbian, Austrian, Russian, French archives.
Mm.
Places often overlooked in earlier accounts that were, let's be honest, quite nationalistic.
So he gets this genuinely panoramic view.
Yeah, a 360-degree perspective, which lets him see the connections and, crucially, the misconnections between all the players.
Which brings us to that title, The Sleepwalkers. That metaphor captures it perfectly.
It really does. He shows how these leaders in all the capitals were intensely focused on their next step, their immediate problem, like a sleepwalker navigating a room.
But completely blind to the bigger picture, the cliff edge they were all heading towards together. Watchful but unseeing, as he puts it.
Exactly. They could see the tactical moves, but missed the catastrophic strategic outcome they were creating collectively.
Okay, so let's unpack the core argument for you listening. The central idea is this war wasn't some mastermind plot by one country.
No. Clark throws that out. He argues it was a systemic breakdown, a tragedy born out of miscalculations, really poor communication, and a kind of shared responsibility among all the major powers. Austria-Hungary, Russia, France, Britain, Germany, they all played a part.
And a huge part of his argument is where he starts the story. It's not where you'd expect.
Right. He radically shifts the focus. Forget Berlin or London, at least initially. He says you have to start in the Balkans. Specifically, the incredibly tense, long-running relationship between Serbia and the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
That volatile regional dynamic is the key.
It's the absolute foundation. Understanding that, Clark argues, is essential to grasp why Austria-Hungary reacted the way it did later. It wasn't just some random overreaction.
So the failure wasn't a single bad actor, but the whole system, those defensive alliances we learned about, the Triple Alliance, the Triple Entente.
Yeah, the Triple Alliance being Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy, though Italy initially stayed out. And the Triple Entente was Britain, France, and Russia. Clark shows how these alliances, meant to provide security, actually hardened into these rigid blocks.
Creating hair triggers.
Exactly. They built these automatic escalation mechanisms. So when that spark hit the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, these rigid systems took what was fundamentally a regional crisis.
And blew it up into a full-blown continental war almost overnight.
That's the mechanism of failure, he describes.
Right. Let's get into the details then, starting where Clark insists we must. Part one, Roads to Sarajevo. For me, this section just completely flips the script on Serbia's role.
It's pretty confronting. Clark doesn't paint Serbia as this passive little victim. He digs deep into the really brutal 1903 coup in Serbia where the king and queen were horribly murdered. That event brought a very aggressive, radical form of nationalism into power.
And with that regime came figures like Colonel Dragutin Dimitrijević, APIS, head of that secret society, the Black Hand.
APIS and the Black Hand are absolutely central to Clark's account. He lays out compelling evidence suggesting the assassination of Franz Ferdinand wasn't just, you know, some lone wolf thing or idealistic students acting alone.
He frames it differently.
He presents it as part of what he calls a sustained campaign of state-sponsored terrorism by elements within the Serbian military and intelligence services, aimed directly at destabilizing Austria-Hungary.
And that context is just crucial, isn't it? Because it explains Vienna's reaction. They didn't just see the assassination as an outrage. They saw it as confirmation of an existential threat.
Exactly. They believed Serbia was actively working to tear their multi-ethnic empire apart by stirring up Slavic nationalism within its borders. So the assassination wasn't just a tragedy. For them, it was the final straw, the casus belli, the justification for war they felt they needed to survive.
Which leads us into part two, one continent divided and the systemic problems. You mentioned the alliances.
Right. The problem was necessarily bad intentions, but how the system constrained everyone. Those famous blank checks, France essentially giving Russia carte blanche, Germany doing the same for Austria.
Yeah.
They created powerful offensive options, yes.
But they also locked everyone in, reduced the room for maneuver.
Hugely. And the most dangerous constraint, the one that really put everyone in a straitjacket, was what Clark calls the primacy of military planning.
Ah, the infamous war plans.
This is where the sleepwalking really becomes apparent. Military staffs across Europe had developed these incredibly detailed, complex mobilization timetables. The German Schlieffen Plan is the most famous example.
The one that required invading France through neutral Belgium.
Yes, because they believed it was the only way to quickly defeat France before turning to fight Russia, avoiding a dreaded two-front war. But these plans were incredibly inflexible.
So once the July crisis kicked off, the generals were basically telling the politicians, look, if Russia mobilizes, we have to launch our plan within hours or we've already lost.
That's essentially it. Political leaders lost control. Mobilization wasn't just a threat anymore. Clicking that button set in motion an irreversible military machine. Following the timetable became paramount, even if it meant violating neutrality. It effectively was the declaration of war. Diplomacy simply couldn't keep up.
And Britain's role in this complex failure, Sir Edward Grey, the Foreign Secretary, it wasn't straightforward.
No. Clark analyzes Grey's communications very carefully. He argues they were dangerously ambiguous. Britain didn't make its position crystal clear. Would they back France and Russia? Crucially, would they definitely defend Belgian neutrality, which they were treaty-bound to do?
So Berlin took a gamble.
They did. Based partly on Grey's unclear signals, the German leadership calculated wrongly, as it turned out that Britain might just stay out of a continental fight. That miscalculation, fueled by British ambiguity, was fatal. When the Schlieffen Plan necessitated invading Belgium, Britain's entry became almost certain.
That lack of clarity, the rigid plans, it all set the stage for the final awful sequence in part three, Crisis, the actual sleepwalking sequence of the July crisis itself.
It unfolded with terrifying speed. Austria issues its ultimatum to Serbia, deliberately harsh, almost impossible to accept fully because they felt they had to crush this threat.
Which triggers Russia.
Right. Russia feels it has to mobilize to protect Serbia, its Slavic ally, and its own prestige in the Balkans. But Russian mobilization, given the German war plan,
triggers German mobilization. The Schlieffen Plan clicks into gear.
Which then involves invading Belgium.
Which forces Britain's hand. It's like dominoes falling, but faster and with much higher stakes.
And the truly chilling insight Clark offers is that the leaders in every single capital believe they were acting defensively.
That's the paradox, isn't it?
Absolutely. Vienna felt it was fighting for survival. Berlin thought it was following the only plan that could prevent Germany being crushed between France and Russia. St. Petersburg believed it was defending its interests and allies.
But each defensive move looked aggressive and threatening to the others.
Precisely. The system itself created this feedback loop of escalation. It built a momentum that no single leader seemed able to stop.
So if the big takeaway isn't about finding a single villain, but understanding systemic failure, what are the core themes we should really absorb from this?
Okay, theme number one, and we've touched on it a lot, is the rejection of blame. Look, assigning blame feels satisfying, but Clark argues it's historically unproductive. Focusing so long on German guilt actually obscured the bigger, more important question.
Which is?
How was the whole European system structured in a way that made such a catastrophe possible, even likely? Responsibility was spread across the political culture of the time. The lesson isn't punishment. It's understanding and fixing structural weaknesses.
That's a profound shift. Okay, theme two seems to flow from that. Misperception and cognitive failure.
Definitely. Think about the conditions these leaders were operating under. Intense time pressure decisions made in days, sometimes hours. They were working with incomplete, often contradictory, or deliberately misleading information.
And assumptions about what the other side was really up to.
Exactly. Faulty assumptions about intentions were rampant. And Clark makes this fascinating point. The new, faster communications of the era, telegraphs and so on, paradoxically made things worse.
How so?
Because it compressed the time available for careful consideration, for diplomacy. It amplified misunderstandings and accelerated reactions. Faster wasn't necessarily better.
Wow. Okay. Theme three feels incredibly relevant today. Nationalism and the cult of honor.
Oh, absolutely. Aggressive nationalism was a powerful force everywhere, but especially potent, as Clark shows, in the Balkans. It created mindsets where compromise was seen as weakness, as betrayal.
Backing down meant national humiliation.
Right. Honor culture demanded firmness, even recklessness. This encouraged brinkmanship, pushing things to the very edge because nobody wanted to be seen as the one who blinked first. It made de-escalation incredibly difficult.
Clark really has a way with words, doesn't he? He crystallizes these big ideas into memorable phrases. Let's share a few of those key quotes, or at least the essence of them.
For sure. The central metaphor has to be first. The protagonists of 1914 were sleepwalkers, watchful but unseeing, haunted by dreams, yet blind to the reality of the horror they were about to bring into the world.
It's such a powerful image, that watchful but unseeing part. They were paying attention, but to the wrong things, focused on the immediate steps, totally missing the abyss.
Then there's his line about responsibility, which just cuts through the noise. There is no smoking gun in this story, or rather, there is one in the hands of every major character.
Can't get much clearer than that. It's a direct hit on the idea of pinning it all on one culprit. Shared failure.
And finally, that quote about Serbia, which really forces you to rethink the standard narrative. Assassination had become an accepted tool of Serbian foreign policy.
Yeah, that challenges the simple victim narrative and gives crucial context for why Austria felt so threatened. It adds that layer of complexity.
And it's that complexity, that nuance, that makes Clark's work so valuable because it allows us to draw lessons for today.
Okay, let's pivot to that. How can we apply these century-old lessons to our world now? What are the real-life applications?
Well, the first one is a three-stark warning about diplomacy and alliances. Clark's work really cautions against overly rigid automatic security pacts. You know, things like NATO's Article 5 are powerful, but his analysis suggests they absolutely need built-in circuit breakers.
Meaning?
Mechanisms for de-escalation, clear communication protocols, diplomatic off-ramps, ways to prevent a regional spark from automatically triggering a global firestorm because the system demands it. Flexibility is key.
That makes sense. What about for leadership within, say, organizations or businesses?
There's a big lesson there, too. Leaders have to be vigilant that operational plans, whether it's military mobilization schedules or maybe complex project timelines in a company, don't end up dictating strategy.
Don't let the how override the why.
Exactly. Don't let the technical demands of the plan put you in a straitjacket where you lose sight of the bigger goal or changing circumstances. You need to retain independent judgment and the ability to adapt, even under pressure.
And I can definitely see the sleepwalker idea applying on a personal level, too.
Oh, absolutely. Think about arguments, conflicts at work or home. How often do we get tunnel vision? We focus so much on winning the immediate point, on our tactical advantage,
that we completely miss the bigger picture, the long-term damage we might be doing to the relationship, the catastrophe we're co-creating.
Right. Clark's work is a powerful reminder that in escalating conflicts, blame is often shared. And the real goal shouldn't be winning the battle, but breaking the destructive cycle itself.
For me, reflecting on this, the biggest shock is the sheer contingency of it all. It wasn't inevitable. It wasn't destiny. It was this awful cascade of decisions, misjudgments, system flaws, points where different choices could have been made. The failure, as you said, was systemic. It's a chilling lesson in how complex systems can be inherently fragile.
And that leads perfectly into the final thought I'd leave you with.
Yeah.
If we genuinely want to prevent future catastrophes, big international ones, or even failures within our own organizations or lives, we have to get uncomfortable. Yeah. We have to constantly question our assumptions, especially the comfortable ones.
Move beyond just pointing fingers.
Yes. Move past the easy satisfaction of blame and focus relentlessly on identifying and fixing the underlying systemic vulnerabilities. It's about building in flexibility, insisting on clear, unambiguous communication, and safeguarding independent judgment, particularly when things get complex and the pressure mounts. That's the hard, necessary work.
A truly sobering but incredibly insightful deep dive. Clark doesn't just recount history, he gives us a framework for understanding how complex systems fail and perhaps how to prevent them from failing again.
Indeed. Powerful lessons.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.